Funding for Think comes from SMU's Master of Liberal Studies.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. What would your life be like if you could literally print money? While the majority of counterfeiters in the U.S. today produce bills that wouldn't fool a fast food cashier, there are a small number of criminal craftsmen who can trace their legacy back centuries. And even in the age of high-quality scanners and printers, making convincing fakes takes an exceptional amount of skill, intelligence, and patience, qualities not often associated with perpetrators of other kinds of crime. More remarkable still, as writer Jason Kirsten will tell us, is the fact that for at least one highly successful counterfeiter, the real payoff was about far more than easy money. Kirsten's new book is called The Art of Making Money, The Story of a Master Counterfeiter. Jason, welcome to Think.
Thanks for having me on.
So your first story about Art Williams came in the form of an article you wrote for Rolling Stone in 2005. Can you talk about how that assignment came about?
Well, that assignment actually came about through my book agent, and he had been in contact with a man named Paul Pompian, and Paul discovered Art Williams while he was in Chicago. Art was his driver, and Paul is a Hollywood producer, and when Art heard that Paul was from Hollywood, he says, well, you should hear my story, and of course, Paul blew him off because everybody says that to him. But on his last day in Chicago, he took Art to lunch. Art told him his story, and Paul was just absolutely floored by it. And he eventually contacted my agent wanting to do a book out of it. I said, I don't know if I want to do a book. I don't even know this guy. He's a crook. But you know what? Let me talk to him, and maybe we'll start with a magazine article and see where that takes us. So to make a long story long, I guess that's how it happened.
Well, let's talk about William's childhood. He started life in a relatively stable home and experienced that long enough to make him crave that kind of normalcy throughout his entire life.
Right. When he was a little kid, he was, you know, his parents were together. His dad was a crook himself and in and out of prison. But there was this period of time where, you know, they lived in a house in the suburbs of Chicago. The marriage was fairly stable, but it didn't last that long. But long enough for Art to get a taste of normalcy, should we say. And, you know, eventually his dad started taking the family on the road, passing bad checks, and as things sort of started to unravel, Art really clung on to school and academics, and he was a brilliant little kid. He skipped two grades, and if things hadn't turned out the way he did, you know, he might have been a very successful and legitimate business.
Yeah, and he was also a natural artist.
Yes, he was. That was actually something he learned in a boys' home, when he had been separated from his parents for various reasons. And he entered a contest. I think that he was probably in the fifth or sixth grade when this happened, and he won the art contest at his school.
One of the things that he didn't learn until decades later was that his father had sexually molested his older sister. Did that revelation change the way he felt about his dad?
Well, you know, he didn't even learn this until long after you know, he had had a second parting with his dad. His sister didn't tell him. And by then, he was very upset by that, but his dad had already sort of betrayed him again by then, so it was one more thing.
So for a long time, though, he did sort of romanticize the relationship he'd had with his father and how much fun they had when they were together.
Oh, absolutely. Mm-hmm. You know, he romanticized it. And at the same time, it was more of this empty thing inside of him and a question of what had happened with his dad. And, you know, to sort of catch listeners up, his dad left his family when he was about 8 or 9, and he just disappeared. They never heard from him again. They didn't know what happened to him. His mom was later diagnosed with bipolar schizophrenia, and they wound up in the housing projects in Chicago. And he had always really wanted to know more than anything why his dad had left him like that.
So while he was living with his mom in the projects in Chicago, things really started to go downhill. At one point, they were literally starving. And then out of desperation, he figured out how to get money for food.
Yeah, that was the first crime Art Williams ever committed was, you know, the kids hadn't eaten in 2 days. The mom was you know, suffering a psychotic episode. And he didn't want to go to social services or the church because he was afraid that they'd take his mother away, which had happened before. So he runs out onto the street with his little brother, and he starts banging on the parking meters on Halstead Street, hearing the change inside. And eventually he devises a little key that'll unlock them. and he gets about $50 in change, brings home a bunch of groceries, and his mom is thrilled. He fed his family. So crime for him began as a way of surviving.
Yeah, and what's so interesting in the way you tell that particular anecdote is that his memory of the event seems to revolve at least as much around his mom's pride and his ingenuity as in his ability to sort of fill their bellies for a few days.
Right. I mean, it was all sort of wrapped up together in this one package, and I think he'd have spend the rest of his life trying to separate these things.
So he's pretty young. He has a girlfriend that he's very serious about, and she gets pregnant. Can you talk about what happened there?
Yeah. So by the time he's 16, his teen girlfriend, she's pregnant. She's an aspiring Chicago police officer. Someday she wants to go up to be a cop.
And let the ironies
begin.
So he
starts stealing cars as a way to save money. He also starts working construction, but the car theft thing winds him up in juvenile hall, and what happens is when he gets out, his mother's boyfriend takes him to the side and says, this street crime thing is going to get you in trouble. Your kid's going to have a crummy life, but I can show you another crime that is far safer and far more lucrative.
And
that turns out to be counterfeiting.
Yeah, he had a whole little operation set up.
Yeah, and mom's boyfriend, Art, nicknamed him Da Vinci. Because he was so good with his hands and with printing, and so Da Vinci takes Art into his print shop on the South Side and teaches him the ropes, the art of counterfeiting, which is very much a legacy crime. It's not something you really learn how to do by yourself. It's something that's passed on through generations. That was something that really fascinated me in the book. Da Vinci had learned from, I think it was his uncle. His uncle had learned from another relative, and this had gone way back.
Yeah, so it was almost like he was taking on an apprentice.
It was exactly like he was taking on an apprentice. That's exactly what was happening.
And so he gives Art three rules, essentially, for counterfeiting that he seems to never have forgotten. Can you talk about those?
One of the things is, don't tell anybody what you're doing, obviously. Never spend the money where you're making it or in the area where you live, because that allows the Secret Service to get a bead on your location. And I think the other rule, he had a lot of rules, but I think it was always find out where the money's going. That's another one.
And it's really interesting to me. I guess I wouldn't have thought about this, but counterfeiters typically don't keep all the money and use it for their personal expenses. They sell it or find ways to launder it to get real money.
Yeah, when you're a master counterfeiter, you're not passing it out. What you're doing is you're selling it to criminal organizations for 30, 40, 50 cents on the dollar if you're really good. And that way it separates you from where the money pops, as Art likes to say, where it hits the marketplace. So you want to be two or three people removed from that to make you safe. And so that's what he did in the early days of his career as a counterfeiter. He would sell to Mexican mafia, the Russian mafia, the Chinese mafia was his favorite client. And, of course, we get to meet all these characters from Chicago Underworld in the book.
And then I was also interested that a lot of the print runs come out and they create bills that aren't convincing enough. And so there were times when Art and his mom's boyfriend would literally throw this money in the fire.
Oh, yeah, they'd have to burn it. I mean, Art sometimes, he thinks he might have burned more than he ever made. he was a perfectionist. And if he saw something he just didn't feel comfortable about, rather than putting the money out there and worrying about it, he would just burn it. He'd go to a garbage can, throw it in, douse it, and, watch all these hundreds of thousands of dollars in fakes go up in smoke. But that was safer than putting it out there.
How much counterfeit cash is estimated to be in circulation in the U.S. at any one time?
Oh, boy. At any one time, it's very small. The number is astonishingly low. I think it's less than one half of 1%, that number changes from year to year. But your odds of having a counterfeit bill are in your pocket right now are very low. At a time, as much as a third of all the currency was counterfeit right after the Civil War, which is astonishing to even think about.
And the Secret Service used to have that as its only job, not just one of its jobs.
Yeah, that was its very first mission. It was one of the last acts of Abraham Lincoln as president was to create this agency to go out and chase down these counterfeiters, to infiltrate them, get them to turn on one another. And I think within 40 years, they had put so many counterfeiters away that the agency could move on to presidential protection as well. And they had done such a good job at that that they were tasked with this second mission.
And I was surprised to read that at a time in American history, there was no sort of universal currency. Banks would actually put out these notes, and so people had no way of knowing if what they accepted was good or not.
Right. People would have to read broadsheets to get an idea of which bills from which bank were any good, and they'd read them every day to make sure that they weren't getting counterfeit. Every bank, your local bank, had its own engravers who would engraved plates, and then they'd print those, make their own money. So each bank was its own mint.
Jason, for people who haven't really given it serious thought, can you talk about why rampant counterfeiting would be so detrimental to a healthy economy?
It's the old saying, bad money tends to drive out good money in any economy. So everybody has to agree on a medium of exchange, and they have to agree that that medium is authentic. Otherwise, the economy will completely break down. There has to be trust in the currency, which is why it's so vital. And, you know, we used to hang counterfeiters in this country, and some countries, they still put them to death because it really challenges the basis of an economic system and therefore challenges authority.
And what makes it so hard to create in this age of digital scanners and things like that? Why is it so incredibly hard to make convincing counterfeit money?
Well, if you really want to take it to the level where, you know, someone is looking at the bill and looking at all its security measures and they can't tell the difference, there are many steps you have to go through. You have to make sure the paper is just right. You have to make sure it has a watermark in it. It has the security strip. It has ultraviolet ink. There are just many, many facets to a bill that can give away a counterfeit. So having a poor quality counterfeit is very easy. A lot of people just sort of run them off on scanners and inkjet printers and try to pass them in a dark bar. Many of them succeed. The vast majority of them get caught right away. But Art wanted a bill that would go all the way to the bank, as he put it. In other words, no one would notice it. They'd hold the bill up to the light. They'd see the watermark. They'd see the strip. And that was the amazing thing about his money. You really couldn't tell the difference unless you knew a lot about money.
So he had only had, I guess, a handful of these sort of training sessions with his mom's boyfriend before suddenly he vanished.
Yeah, Da Vinci just disappeared one day. Art really had no answers to what happened to him. He wondered if he had been killed in a deal with someone, one of his clients, perhaps. He wondered if the Secret Service had gotten wind of him. But Da Vinci just disappeared one day. He took off, and, yet another sort of paternal abandonment in his life.
Since the article and the book have come out, have you heard from anybody who thinks they know what happened to this guy?
No. In fact, Art told me when we were doing this that one of the things he really hoped would happen with this book was that Da Vinci would try to contact him and come out. But that hasn't happened yet.
Jason Kirsten is my guest. He is a writer who originally wrote a piece on Art Williams for Rolling Stone magazine. He has expanded it into a full-length book called The Art of Making Money, The Story of a Master Counterfeiter. We'll return to our conversation in just a moment and invite you to join us by calling 1-800-933-5372 or sending email to think@kera.org.
Funding for Think comes from SMU's Master of Liberal Studies, offering a progressive graduate degree with flexible part-time study. You can pursue your passion at SMU, and you can learn more at smu.edu/MLS.
You're You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd, speaking this hour with Jason Kirsten. His new book is called The Art of Making Money, The Story of a Master Counterfeiter. If you'd like to join us, you can send an email to think@kera.org, or you can call 1-800-933-5372, and that's where we find Charlie in Lakewood. Hi, Charlie.
Hi. Jason, can you tell us how the North Koreans got started in printing their notoriously fine $100 bill, and if that problem is still existing?
Yeah, you're talking about the super note. I've heard numerous things about how they got started. I heard that Iran set them up with an intaglio press, which is the same kind of press we use to print our genuine currency on. This has been all over the news a lot lately because, boy, I just think it was just a few weeks ago, the Washington Times came out with an article in which they identified the North Korean general who's actually running this operation. And this had been something that the State Department and the Secret Service has been sitting on for a long time. It looks like they've known for a very long time that the super note has come from North Korea, but they've been very reluctant to say exactly who and where and what's doing it. And they've been using it as sort of a bargaining chip with the six-party talks. But now, in the recent weeks, we've seen the most clear revelations coming about this super note, which has really been a mystery for a long time, exactly where it was coming from. Some people said it was China. Some people said it was Eastern Europe. We've always said it was North Korea, but we've backed away from that position many times when it's been in our interest.
So Art Williams did not have access to an intaglio press, but he was sort of headquartered in the heart of the country's publishing industry, which is Chicago. Can you talk about what he had to sort of set up when he decided to make his own shop?
Chicago's great. I mean, the whole graphic arts industry, it's the largest concentration in the world of that industry. And so when he set up his first shop, which he nicknamed The Dungeon, you have to find a quiet place when you're running that press, so you don't make a lot of noise, and you also need to vent some of the chemicals and ink smells. So he got a dungeon apartment. It's like that old song from the B-52s, "We're in the basement." It was exactly where he was. So he started off as a straight offset counterfeiter, which means he's using an offset press, and he's burning plates, making plates that he sticks into that press and then uses to run off the money.
So, and when you say offset, basically the plates hit a bit of rubber, and then the rubber actually stamps the paper.
Exactly.
Okay. And he has a process as well, or had one, and we can let people know that this is difficult enough that even by revealing this process, we're not teaching any counterfeiters to do anything.
Yeah, that's absolutely true.
Yeah. So can you talk about what he did in order to defeat some of the, at the time, existing security measures on American currency?
Right. Well, Art's big claim to fame and what really transformed his operation was when the money changed in 1996 and we had the new $100 bill. Art wanted to crack that $100 bill more than anything. And so he set about experimenting, and he did just that. And one of the first things he wanted to do was nail that paper, because at the same time the money was changing, the anti-counterfeiting pen was very present. A lot of stores still use this. They whip out that pen and mark a $100 bill to make sure it marks yellow. And so he devised a paper that would pass the pen test. It actually turned out to be directory paper, which is used in phone books. And so that was one thing. He got the color-shifting ink. What gave him that idea was he saw a car, I think it was a Mustang, that had this ink that shifted. And he made some phone calls calling auto body shops and found out where to get this paint. Turns out the people who patented the technology for the paint are the same one who patented for the color-shifting ink on our money.
It's convenient.
Wild. And so there was that. And then the watermark really came to him in a dream. That was the hardest thing to do because the watermark is made during the paper-making process. And he didn't want to become a paper maker. And so he figured out that he could get two very thin sheets of directory paper and sort of sandwich his own watermark and security strip in between them. So his bill, it was really like a little sandwich that occasionally came apart if the climate was humid enough, and that led to some interesting scenarios.
And then this was not a single process, obviously. He would have to print over and over to get layers of color and ink on these papers.
Oh, yeah, many steps. He would use, his build is technically called a hybrid build, meaning that he would use a computer and a scanner for some elements of the bill, and then he would use the offset press for things like the seals and serial numbers to get the effect that he wanted. So they call it a hybrid because he's using, it's both digital and old-school offset technology.
So how much time did it take, Jason, to produce a batch of these bills?
Well, he often, you know, worked in $100,000 batches. He didn't like to print more because the more money, the sketchier things become when it hits the street. It would take him 4 or 5 days to do $100,000. Now, one of the things he really liked to do is he'd print all the elements because his bill was like a kit. So he could have his front and his back of a bill, a bunch of watermarks, a bunch of security strips, and he could actually put all this into a box and then hit the road. And he and his girlfriend would do this. They'd hit the road, and they'd assemble the bills in hotel rooms, and then they'd go hit malls all across America. They'd go in, and within a few hours, they could come out with $5,000 in real money by changing those $100 bills for real change.
People might be interested, by the way, that his girlfriend was a ticket agent at the DFW airport.
Yeah, his girlfriend's from Texas, from Denton. And, yes, she was doing that for a while.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. You can also send email to think@kera.org. Let's go next to Roscoe in Dallas. Hey, Roscoe.
Hey, good afternoon. I appreciate the show today. I was wondering if this, of course, made me think of Frank Abagnale. They made the movie, of course, Catch Me If You Can. And I was wondering if these counterfeiters are aware of each other. Do they share secrets, or are they also secretive among themselves?
Well, that's a really interesting question. I mean, Art and Frank don't know each other, and of course they kind of did different things. Art, you know, I asked him when he eventually went to federal prison. You know, I said, "Well, didn't you meet any other counterfeiters in there?" And he said, "There were a couple guys in there, but I would talk to him, and I realized quickly that they didn't really know what they were doing." And so, in terms of sharing secrets, it's interesting. I wonder if they're almost territorial, like lions or something. And if you know another counterfeiter is operating in your territory, maybe you wouldn't, you know, he'd be a competitor technically. So I don't know if they're that, they tend to be loners.
So they would go on these cross-country jaunts, and one of the things they did was buy small items with a $100 bill to get the cash in return, but they were buying things that they couldn't use. Can you talk about what they did with everything?
Well, yeah, you know, once they started hitting malls, and that was by the way, that was one of the rules that Da Vinci had taught Art. Don't go spending your own money and passing your own money. But Art gave in to temptation because his new money was so good, and he really wanted to see what it could do. They'd hit a mall for 3 or 4 hours, he and his girlfriend, and then they'd have, you know, a trunk full of junk, so to speak. And they quickly decided that, you know, they didn't need this stuff. So they'd immediately look up the Salvation Army in that local town, and they'd drop all these new goods off the Salvation Army. And eventually this donation aspect to the crime, I mean, that became almost as addictive to them as counterfeiting. They loved this Robin Hood thing that they'd do.
Do you sense that he had any sense of guilt over what he was doing?
No. I know he had no sense. In fact, a shrink would, you know, later on, confront him and say, you know, I think the reason you guys would donate all these goods and give away all this money was to alleviate the sense of guilt. And Art said, well, you know, that's a pretty good theory if I had felt guilty to begin with. The only thing he ever felt guilty about were the effects that it would have on his family and friends and involving them in the crime. But the thing about this crime is most counterfeiters feel no guilt because they put so much work into making the money that they almost look at it as real money. And Art's money looked so real, it felt real, everyone treated it as real, and in his mind, it eventually was real.
Can you talk about that first encounter that you had with him where he showed you a bill and sort of describe what it felt like for you to hold something that you knew wasn't real but looked and felt exactly like a genuine bill?
Yeah, that was extraordinary. And I actually have one of his bills now. When I first met him, he didn't give me a bill. I mean, that would have been involving me in a felony, but he had some paper that he used, and paper was one of his specialties. And we had been drinking some beers, and he really didn't want to tell me this. His wife did not want to reveal this to me. But after a few beers, I got him to show me this one aspect of the crime. And so he whipped out a couple pieces of paper, glued them together as a way to show me how, really a rough idea of what he was doing, and then sprayed it with some chemicals. And then when he gave me that bill, boy, I closed my eyes and I held a piece of genuine currency in one hand and his little paper set up in the other, and I could not tell the difference. And then I'll never forget, he says, "Now snap that." And I snapped it, and it just had the ring of money to it. It was extraordinary.
How much did he actually spend on himself? He was, for a while at least, sort of living large.
Yeah, well, no one could blow money like Art. I mean, he'd do a deal, and, he'd have $20,000, and that could be gone in a couple days. He'd blow it on buying drinks for the whole bar, clothes, living the high life. If he had actually bothered to invest his money and come out with, sophisticated ways of laundering it, he'd be a millionaire today. But it was always this feast or famine lifestyle. I don't think he was doing it ever to get rich. I think his first goal had always gone all the way back to that first crime when he was a kid, of surviving and then surviving well. But so he would just live the easy life for a time after he'd do one of these deals where he didn't work, didn't do much of anything. And then he'd run out of money, and then, whoops, we better go back to the printing press.
In fact, at one point he was doing pretty well for himself in Chicago, but his mother called, and she was living in Texas, and said, "Please come and be with me."
Right. Well, at that point, Art's wife, they were having, or the mother of his baby, they were having relationship problems, and she started dating a police officer, I think he was a retired police officer, and Art was really messed up in the head, and he wanted to kill this guy, and everyone knew it, and so his mother got wind of this situation, and she said, "Calm down to Valley View, just get out of Chicago, I sense there's very bad things going on with you." And so he did. He took his mom's advice and came down to Texas, with the idea being he's going to clean up his life.
Will you talk for a minute, by the way, this woman's name was Karen, that he was first with and who he had his first child with. And he sort of got a little thrill out of keeping all of this secret from a woman who dreamed of nothing more than becoming a police officer herself.
Yeah, he would, every morning he'd put on a windbreaker for a construction company that he was supposedly working for. And then she would drop him off at a construction site, and then, as soon as she turned the corner, he'd just grab a cab and go to the dungeon where he was printing money. And, it was a game for him and for her, because he always had money, and she was trying to figure out where it was coming from. And he'd say, "Oh, I got a paycheck. Where's the pay stub? Oh, I lost it." So it was this very much of a cat and mouse game at first. And, but eventually, Art was playing with fire there, because Karen did want to be a police officer. She did want a legitimate life, and it took its toll on her and put strains on their relationship.
So when he moved down to Texas, he had a very strange sort of domestic arrangement. He had four girlfriends, all of whom not only knew about the existence of one another, but they would hang out together.
Yeah. Yeah, one of the things you got to understand about Art, he's a very good-looking guy. Very charming. All the women sort of I'd interviewed for this book that knew him and had been with him, that was one of the first things they'd say. They'd say, "Yeah, I knew he was criminal, but you got to understand he was also very smart and he was very good looking." And now he wasn't with them all at the same time. He would sort of go from one to the next, these girls in Texas. And eventually he ended up with Natalie. But all the girls knew each other, and they were friends, and they'd sort of, pass him off to each other as young people are want to do.
So she stuck by him once he finally went to prison for counterfeiting. Can you talk about how he got caught that time?
Yeah. Well, you mean in Texas?
Yeah.
Yeah, that wasn't for counterfeiting.
That was stealing cars?
No, that was actually a robbery that he did. It was a very dark moment. He had given up counterfeiting when he came down to Texas for a while. And he'd given up crime completely. He was building houses and places like Plano and stuff. But eventually he slipped back into one of his old favorite crimes, which was robbing drug dealers. And that led to a criminal association of a guy who said that a jeweler had hired him to rob his house. And Art took his word for it, and they went in to rob the house. Turned out the guy had lied to him. And anyway, they got caught for that. He went to prison in Texas. But she stayed in touch with him. She was the only one of the girls who would go to visit him when he was down in the Lopez State Jail. And that really kind of became very symbolic to him, that she really cared about him. And so she was right there when he got out. And when he started counterfeiting again, she became his accomplice.
Well, it makes some sense that Art would want to talk to you because he wanted his story told, and it was sort of, you know, another, I guess, you know, notch in his cap or something. But why did everybody else want to talk to you about all this, do you think?
I think that a lot of people, well, one thing, they all thought it was an extraordinary story. They knew Art had this amazing story, and I think they wanted to support Art, really. I mean, many of the people in the book had access to his money, had seen his money, and they also knew what had happened with his dad, and I don't want to give away the ending of the book.
Yeah, we won't go there.
Yeah, and they also knew how badly his life had gone, and they saw this, much as I saw it, in which he was talking to me, was a way of rejecting his life of crime, a way of sort of putting everything out in the open, committing criminal suicide, and you know, hopefully that would work, but it didn't work out that way.
Jason Kirsten is my guest. His new book is called The Art of Making Money, The Story of a Master Counterfeiter. If you want to join us or ask a question, you can call 1-800-933-5372, or you can send email to think@kera.org.
Funding for Think comes from SMU's Master of Liberal Studies, offering a progressive graduate degree with flexible part-time study. You can pursue your passion at SMU, and you can learn more at smu.edu/MLS.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is Jason Kirsten. His new book is called The Art of Making Money, The Story of a Master Counterfeiter. If you would like to join us, you can call 1-800-933-5372 or send email to think@kera.org. You know, somebody mentioned earlier the Abagnale story that was told in the movie Catch Me If You Can. And one of the things that he did was get contracts after he was finished with prison and everything else to be a security consultant. Can you talk about the offers that Art Williams had to do sort of similar work?
Yeah, this is interesting. This is, you know, I was very much hoping that Art would become the next Frank Abagnale Jr. and take all of the knowledge and turn it to good. And, you know, just after the Rolling Stone article came out, he got an offer from a big company in upstate New York, a document security company, as a consultant and to do speeches, mainly to law enforcement, about some of the things he did to, you know, beat the 1996 New Note. And he did his first speech, and I think there were about 500 law enforcement officers. He was absolutely terrified, you know, to the point where he was vomiting before going on stage because he'd spent his whole life hiding from these guys. And, you know, he takes the stage and he gets up there, and then, you know, he has this prepared speech, and then finally he just falls apart because he's so nervous, and he says, "I got to tell you people, you know, you have no idea how scared I am because I've spent my whole life, you know, running from you guys." And that got a big laugh, and then his speech apparently was a huge hit. He got a standing ovation, and, you know, everything was looking good, but unfortunately, you know, Art from time to time has had problems with drugs, and he failed a drug test when he got back to Chicago. His parole officer you know, that was a reason to deny him the ability to leave the state, and so he couldn't perform that job. And, of course, the first thing he does out of, you know, resentment and feeling that he's put in a corner is he goes right back to printing money.
Let's go back to the phones and speak with John in Denton. Hi, John.
Hi. Jason, I think you said one of his girlfriends was named Natalie and that she was from Denton. Can you talk about how they met and what her background is and what she's doing now?
Yeah, they met at a party and in Denton. You know, Art, it's interesting. Art's mom's from Valley View, and so when he came down to Valley View, he's down there. It's a small town. There's not much to do. But the next-door neighbor was a woman, and she introduced Art to all these girls from Denton. And she's not, you know, she's not living there anymore. But you know, she and Art have three kids together. So she's raising those kids right now is what she's doing. He's back in prison, and she's, you know, waiting for him to get out.
Did you always have the sense, Jason, that he was telling you the truth about everything?
No. You know, what he wasn't telling me, the main thing that he wasn't telling me the truth about when, you know, we started, you know, working together, first with the Rolling Stones story and, you know, later with the book, was, you know, he had led me to believe that he had quit counterfeiting. And there would be times when I'd try to get a hold of him. I couldn't get a hold of him for 2 or 3 weeks before he'd call me back. And that's when I started getting a sinking feeling that he was up to something. In terms of what he, you know, what he did tell me in, about his past and his story, boy, he really didn't, you know, I thought that, you know, is a criminal, can I trust everything he's saying? But very often he'd downplay some of the scenarios that he had gotten into. And the truth actually would turn out to be much more dramatic than what he was telling me. So he wasn't lying to me in terms of the past. He was lying to me in terms of the present.
It had to have been a challenge when you did the first article, because I know Rolling Stone has fact checkers like any other magazine. I mean, how do you go about checking facts on people who sort of operate in this underworld?
Well, at that time, we had, you know, the Secret Service was very cooperative, and we had court documents and things like that. And, you know, you confirm with who you can confirm with, you know. If Art's talking about what happened in Alaska, you know, there's people in Alaska that they can call and confirm that this happened like this. And, you know, but, you know, everybody liked Art, and most people were willing to tell me stories, provided if they were criminals, they wouldn't, you know, no way you can use my real name. So that was a compromise I'd have to do from the beginning. And there were other people who just wouldn't talk to me, you know, like some of his clients, for example. You know, they were still active criminals, and they didn't need their name out there. But, you know, you've got to confirm what you can confirm, and I was actually surprised at how much we were able to confirm.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Next up, we'll speak to Asher in Dallas. Hey, Asher.
Hi. I heard that somebody had called and was talking about the film Catch Me If You Can. I was wondering about the film To Live and Die in L.A., movie from the 80s. In which Willem Dafoe stars as a counterfeiter. And I was wondering if there was any influence on either side with Rick Masters and Art, and I'll just take my response off the air.
Yeah, that's great. You know, Art has a kind of a funny relationship with this movie because, you know, there aren't that many counterfeiter movies out there. And, of course, that, you know, that's a great one from the very beginning where you see Willem Dafoe in his own printing hole, you know, doing the money, shooting the negatives, making the plates while that music's running. And, you know, Art, you know, he has a love-hate relationship with the movie because he loves the movie, but he hates the way counterfeiters are portrayed there. Willem Dafoe's a killer in that movie. You know, he's killing Secret Service agents and lawyers and other people. He's bloodthirsty, and Art, you know, very opposed to that. He says, it's a nonviolent crime. Don't they get it? You know, we're not killers. That's why we're doing it in the first place, is because we don't like to be violent. And so he'd always get very frustrated when he'd watch that movie. But in terms of actually influencing him, no, it didn't have any influence in getting him into it.
Well, you mentioned that there is a movie planned for this story. Have the roles been cast yet?
No, not yet. I mean, it's there's a script out there based, well, very loosely on the magazine article, and it's, you know, my feeling is it has the problems. We have a book out now. Paramount has the rights. They were you know, Hollywood, you can never believe anything they tell you. They'll tell you 1 week, oh, yes, we've got, you know, Steven Spielberg's going to make it, and the next week, oh, no, that's not the way it goes. So as a writer, I just got to kind of sit back and wait and see what happens.
You get a straighter story talking to the criminals.
Yeah, you know what? You're absolutely right.
So you mentioned that art is very handsome and sort of dashing. Is there a type, I don't mean for you to cast the movie, but is there an actor that we would relate to that would remind us of him?
Yeah, you know, it's funny. I watched the the new Star Trek movie about a month ago, and Captain Kirk, Chris Pine, looks a lot like Art did at 26 years old. And at the time, there was actually some talk in the rumor mill that he was interested in playing Art, but like everything else, that just sort of disappeared off into the Hollywood vagaries. But I think he actually would be a good Art.
We have an email here from Bill in Dallas who writes, every time I go to Russia and exchange U.S. currency, I encounter a monumental discrimination toward any less than perfect bill. They won't accept currency that's been folded or written on. Why do you think they're so picky in this regard? Is it probably a counterfeit thing?
Yeah, Russia has a lot of counterfeiting going on there. There they call it Falsheviki. And especially in St. Petersburg, there's a lot of people counterfeiting there. I don't know what the current status is, but I know, I think it was about 10 years ago, they were having big problems with people counterfeiting $100 bills. And it's funny, Art did sell to the Russians, too. I used to wonder if any of his bills wound up in Russia, because I do know that some of his bills left the country.
I think it's pretty interesting that when he finally started doing this on his own, he started not with hundreds, but with 20s.
Well, this was when he needed to get back up to speed right after he got out of prison. He didn't have the kind of money that he needed to set up a really good shop. And so sometimes he'd do this building thing where he'd start with 20s, do a quick deal, turnarounds to raise the revenue to improve his equipment so he could do the hundreds. But hundreds were, you know, always his number one bill. If he had the equipment and he had the place and he had the funds, he'd made $100 bills. 20s was just something he would do to get by for a short period of time.
How did he decide who he could trust and who he needed to work with when he was trying to sell this stuff?
Well, that's a good question. You know, Art has a very strong street sense, being from the streets. And, you know, he has been burned from time to time throughout his criminal career. But a lot of the people he trusted were people he had known since he was a kid, people he had longstanding relationships with. And, you know, Art's a smart guy. He would look at various criminals and see how they held themselves. You know, were these people big talkers? Did they shoot their mouths off? Were they reckless? You know, could they be depended on was his number one thing. And, of course, are they gonna squeal on you? Are they going to turn you in? So tight childhood friends was the sort of the core of his little crew that he would use to occasionally help him make money and distribute it. He tried not to bring new strangers in.
Do they actually use phrases like you just said, squeal? That reminds me of an old, you know, movie from the 30s or something. Are they throwing those terms around in the actual world of crime?
No, I don't think I'd ever use that word, actually. that's me using that word. You know, he would say something, you know, you got to keep your mouth shut. That would probably be how he'd put it.
Jason, what about the new bills that came out a couple years ago that are supposed to be the most secure yet? What makes them so different? And we know how they look different, but why are they different than even the ones that came out in 96?
Well, you know, Art would actually, I talked to him about this, and, you know, he had a good look at them, and he doesn't think they're that much better. They have more colors on them. They have, you know, a few more little numbers on them and markings. But in terms of security measures, it's just more work, but there's nothing as dramatic in the more recent currency as there was in 96 when you had the watermark and the color shifting ink and all this. There's just more of the same. There's more of it. So more steps, more hurdles you have to go through. Actually, the new $5 bill, which came out, I think it was in March, is kind of interesting because that has another watermark in it. It has the five. And the reason they did that is because people were bleaching the $5 bills and turning them into hundreds.
Wow.
So that's actually a pretty effective tool there, because now instead of just seeing a portrait, and a lot of people don't even check to see that it's the right portrait, now you got the number in there. So that'll, if you got a five, it's going to say five. So that's very effective. But the next $100 bill is going to be revolutionary. That's going to contain something called micro lenses, where it'll actually look like either the denomination mark or perhaps an image. It's going to look like it's floating above the bill.
That sounds very expensive to produce.
Yeah, I think they're trying to figure out a way to make it cheaper. But they use it on the Swedish money right now.
Have you, since you've started this research, do you now look much more carefully if you happen to have a $100 bill in your possession than you ever did before?
No. What I do is I feel more carefully. Huh. And another thing, I'm a writer. I don't have a lot of $100 bills in my possession. But really, and this was the thing that Art would always tell me, the number one way to tell whether your money is real or not is by feel. You run your thumb across that portrait, and real currency is made on a taglio press, which leaves the ink raised. And so you can feel thousands of tiny little ridges and grooves. And there's nothing, counterfeit money is always flat money. Now, sometimes money gets old and it flattens out, but really the feel is the best way to tell real currency from fake.
Well, that's interesting. You know, not too long ago I had what felt like a fake $5 bill, but I thought, who would bother counterfeiting a $5 bill?
Yeah, a kid maybe, not wanting to get too risky or something. But Art actually used to counterfeit $5 bills as a favor to one of his friends who was a taxi driver. And if the taxi driver didn't like you, he'd give you back these fives of change.
That were not actually real fives.
Yeah, he'd just do special little runs for him because, you know, that was Art's wheelman also. He'd take him to do deals and things.
Were you tempted at all to attempt this just as an exercise to understand what you were doing? Were you tempted to make yourself some fake currency?
Oh, yeah, especially all the things Art had taught me about what he did. But, you know, sort of seeing how his life had been dominated by this and unraveled by it, you know, that temptation never lasts very long. You know, it'll go away within a few minutes. But... No, I was, you know, I was content being the scribe here. I didn't want to become the criminal myself.
I know he's in prison for about 3 more years. Are you still in regular contact with him?
Yeah, we talk, you know, he can talk for 15 minutes at a time. And so we talk once a week until his minutes run out or his, you know, prison bank account runs out. Yeah, we're still in touch.
Does he like the book?
He loves it. He loves the book.
I guess it makes him sort of a star even within the prison, right?
Yeah, well, I tell him to watch out for that because in prison there's always someone who's going to be trying to bring you down. You know, Art's a very smart guy. He's smarter than, I guarantee you, he's smarter than most of the guys he's in prison with. And he tends to keep to himself. But, you know, this is very exciting. He wants everybody in prison to read the book. I said, well, just be calm about it. Someone will try to take you down a few notches, which would be a big mistake because Art is very big now. He's been working out. He's always been into fitness, and he's not somebody you want to tangle with.
Jason Kirsten's new book is called The Art of Making Money, The Story of a Master Counterfeiter. Jason, it's been really fascinating. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
My name is Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening, and have a great day.
Think is produced by Jeff Whittington and engineered by Jeannie Mascoro. Learn about upcoming programs, subscribe to our free daily podcast, and order CD copies of your favorite Think shows on the radio page of KERA.org. And we'd like to hear what you think about Think. Email your comments, questions, and suggestions to think@KERA.org.